It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. He's going to answer Paul Thurrott's question. What exactly is a Pluton? We'll talk about success for the Brave browser, more Log4j vulnerabilities, and then a very interesting deep dive into the problems with URL parsing and why so many programs get it wrong. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 853, recorded Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. URL parsing vulnerabilities. Security Now is brought to you by Acronis. Acronis has collected tools, advice, and practical guides from their global community of MSP partners and their network of IT channel gurus to help you make your MSP business dreams a reality. Check out the Acronis MSP Jumpstart Program. Go to go.acronis.com/twit-one for tools and resources to help you evolve or start your IT business. And by Barracuda. Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack costing companies millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now. Go to barracuda.com/security now. And by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is ridiculously fast. You can stream everything in HD quality with zero buffering. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/security now. It's time for Security Now, the show we cover the latest news from the world of security. Thanks to our professional security analyst, Steve Gibson of GRC.com. He's right. You know, I like the eyebrows.
I were to nod and synchronize my eyebrows, they could stay motionless while my head moved up. I have to work on that.
And there you see on display Steve's amazing analytic abilities. It's just how he thinks, ladies and gentlemen. Well, hi, Steve.
Yo,
let's get going.
Yo.
Here. Yes.
Well, so it's 011122.
Yes.
Security Now 853. A team of four researchers, security researchers in the Northeast, Massachusetts and New York, I think, took it upon themselves to look at another aspect of our libraries that we're all using and discovered some really, really interesting problems, which are right now affecting everyone. And anyway, so it's a really interesting topic, I think. One of our deep dives, those who do not have the advantage of show notes in front of them are going to have to, and I was going to say close your eyes, but not if you're commuting. But if you're being commuted, then that would be good.
And the governor will call any minute now, I'm sure.
then you'll have to picture some of these, but I'll be gentle. Anyway, I think a really interesting topic of URL parsing vulnerabilities. But this week we're going to begin with another in our series of Log4j updates, which includes, among a few other bits of news, an instance of a real-world vulnerability that has popped up, and the FTC's, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's, somewhat surprising and aggressive message relative to Log4j. We'll chronicle the Chrome browser's first largest update of 2022 and also note the gratifying 2021 growth of the privacy-centric Brave browser. WordPress needs updating, but this time not one of those pesky add-ons, but WordPress itself. We're going to then answer the age-old question posed during last Wednesday's Windows Weekly podcast. What exactly is a Pluton, and how many can dance on the head of a pin? And finally, after a quick sci-fi reading recommendation and a very brief touch on my ongoing Spinrite work, we're going to take, as I said, a gratifying deep dive into the unfortunate vagaries of our industry's URL parsing libraries to see just how much trouble we're in as a result of no two of them parsing URLs in exactly the same way.
Interesting. Fascinating. Might I say engaging content, as always, coming up on Security Now. And I will, for those of you watching video, I'll display the images, but you'll just, the rest of you, use your imaginations. And then where do people get the show notes, actually? I should, because people may want to, after the fact, see them. You have them on your website, yes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. grc.com/security now, and they're already posted.
Good.
I did that this morning.
Good.
So the link is there.
Yeah. So that's, I think, perhaps everybody should know that so that they can follow along. The transcripts, the show notes, all of that stuff live at Steve's website. New sponsor, want to welcome. Not a new name. I think everybody who's been around for a while knows Acronis.
Yep.
When Lisa said, do you know Acronis? I said, are you kidding? I'd love to do ads for Acronis. They have some of the best tools out there for managing your PC. I want to talk about their MSP Jumpstart program for managed service providers right now. Whether you're working in freelance IT consulting, maybe you're a break-fix shop or a small reseller, you're in a great position to convert your IT expertise into an established managed service provider business. That's what we use as an MSP. Russell, I've talked about him all the time from Exponentia. That's his company. He's our IT guy, but he's a managed service provider. And it's worked out for us as a company very well economically. We get great service from him. He loves it because he has a – we've tried to hire Russell 100 times, but he loves his being an MSP because he has multiple clients in a lot of different areas. And he likes the variety. He likes moving around. We see him on Wednesdays, but he goes to different places. As you start to build your MSP business, you're going to develop plans and processes and systems. That's what Russell has done. And it's really – it's kind of amazing – because basically comes equipped, fully equipped. It's a turnkey thing. You'll be doing things maybe you didn't even know you needed, systems you're going to set up. The good news is, as an IT professional, you already have the technical expertise and connections that you need to start supporting your first clients. And as for the rest, I want to point you to Acronis, A-C-R-O-N-I-S. And particularly Acronis's MSP Jumpstart program. It helps people who are experts in IT start their own MSP business. They're going to give you support and advice for every step of your journey. Lots of resources, not just the software that we're all familiar with from Acronis, some of the best in the business, but also ebooks, on-demand webinars with experts in the field. Just as a sample kind of what you're going to get, this is how Acronis is going to help, because there are four major steps ahead of you as you build your MSP business from this notion of maybe I'd like to do this to a thriving, profitable organization. Russell just got back from a week-long trip to Budapest, which gives you an idea on a couple of things. First of all, he's making some good money. But second, he could also run his business from anywhere. So he did not leave his clients in the lurch as he's traveling the world. These are some of the areas you're going to want to look at, the four major steps. Number one, planning. If you're going to establish this business as an MSP, a business that'll last, you need a clear and well-organized plan, an understanding of where you can fit into the IT channel, what needs are out there. When it comes to launching, you're going to launch your MSP business. It's going to allow you to flex new strategic business muscles. That's a nice way of saying you're going to have to start thinking like a business person, especially when it comes to marketing, offering your service packages. And again, Acronis can really help there. Now, of course, now that you've got it off the ground, you want to keep it running and keep it running successfully, maybe even keep an eye to expanding and optimizing it. Again, Acronis can help there. And then finally, scaling. You know, you've got your first client, now your second, now your third, now your fourth. You've taken your MSP business from an idea to a reality. How do you give it the boost it needs to keep profits and success growing for years to come? This sounds exciting, doesn't it? Maybe it's something you want to do. As you approach these steps, you're going to learn techniques and strategies that will help you get your IT managed services business started with a strong foundation, optimized for future growth. Maybe you're, in fact, already going down this path. Acronis can help you wherever you are. Go to the next level. Acronis, A-C-R-O-N-I-S, has collected tools, advice, practical guides because they work with MSPs. There's a global community of MSP partners that works with Acronis already. They've combined that knowledge. They have quite a network of IT channel gurus, all of which can help you make your MSP business dreams a reality. I think this is a great idea. Check out the Acronis MSP Jumpstart Program. It's go.acronis.com/twit-1. go.acronis.com/twit-1 to get the tools and resources to help you evolve or even get started in your IT business. This is perfect. You know, we've had IT Pro TV for a while, give you the skills you need to get into IT. Maybe now it's ready. You're ready to go to the next level, become an MSP. go.acronis.com/twit-1. Want to welcome Acronis to the show because we're big fans, believe in them, and I've used their products for years, as has Russell, I know. And I love it that they're offering this kind of advice and expertise to budding MSPs. go.acronis.com/twit-1.
All right, Steve. I love it.
Go ahead.
Now we know how to pronounce their name.
Oh, yeah.
Is it Acronis? It is Acronis? Is it Acronis?
What you know, one of the reasons I like doing a radio show is because I'm often pronouncing words that everybody's been reading for years for the first time.
Yes.
So I get to decide, but I did. I asked Acronis, and they said that's how you say it. Let's get that picture of the week. You ready?
Well, this is another one of those oldies but goodies, or not really old because it's 2021, but they never get they never get tired. Someone tweeted this to me, Dave Hart. He said, "Thought you'd enjoy this screen at O.R. Tambo Airport in Johannesburg, South Africa."
Wow.
And of course, this is, and I love it because it says 2021, year of security culture, it's boasting about. And, you know, it's got, you know, all kinds of extra logos and bureaucratic mumbo jumbo. And right in the middle of the whole thing, otherwise very impressive presentation, is a blue box. It says, "Your Windows license will expire soon."
Yeah.
It's like,
whoops.
Okay. What?
Whoops.
So they're running an unlicensed version of Windows?
Apparently,
or what?
That's secure. Sure.
I wasn't aware that Windows licenses expired. I've never had a license expire.
No. This is what you get if you first install Windows without giving it an authentication code.
Right.
You can
right.
run it for 30, 60, or 90 days, but eventually it says, "Oh no, you gotta enter activate."
Year of security culture, not so much.
Whoopsies.
Anyway, yeah.
Well, we got it on the internet. We thought it would work forever. It must.
And if only there was. It says go to settings. If only you could press the settings button. But no,
it's a kiosk
mode. I don't
think
that's going to happen. Yeah. So anyway, just another fun little bit of flotsam.
Awesome.
Okay, our Log4j update. The U.S. CISA has stated that the log for shell exploit of the log4j vulnerability has not resulted in, quote, significant, unquote, government intrusions yet. CISA said, quote, "We're not seeing confirmed compromises of federal agencies, including critical infrastructure. We are seeing widespread scanning by malicious actors. We're seeing some prevalence of what we would call low-level activities, like installation of crypto mining malware. But we're not seeing destructive attacks or attacks attributed to advanced persistent threats." So it's like, okay, don't relax, everybody. But so far, you know, it's not the end of the world. Eric Goldstein, who's the CISA's executive assistant director for cybersecurity, said that there would be a, quote, long tail remediation because of how widespread the issue is. And of course, that's what we've predicted, too, because of this problem of the Java library, you know, inheritance tree. He said CISA estimates that hundreds of millions of devices are impacted. Easterly said, CISA is aware of reports of attacks affecting foreign government agencies, including the Belgian Defense Ministry. And I did pass over a story about that, as well as reports from cybersecurity firms that nation-state adversaries are developing attacks using Log4Shell, but said CISA cannot independently confirm those reports at this time. So stay tuned. The overall security group posture is that there's scanning being done and implanting occurring to and there's a race to get systems networks penetrated. The exploitation of those penetrations is on a back burner because everyone knows sooner or later those vulnerabilities that are creating the openings are going to close. So, you know, it's frightening because it means the bad guys are like acting in a smart fashion, in a means to optimize their long-term benefit for short-term, you know, for stalling the glory for just getting into systems. So anyway, I think we're going to have an interesting 2022. Meanwhile, Matt Keller, the vice president of federal services at GuidePoint Security, told ThreatPost that many agencies are unable to patch the problems arising for Log4J due to network-connected end-of-life and end-of-service systems. In other words, mission-critical systems that are still in service but which cannot be updated because they've passed out of their maintenance life. You know, there aren't going to be updates coming from them. Like, oh, yes, you got Windows 7? Too bad. Anyway, Matt said that federal agencies are relying upon command line scripts to locate affected systems. They're also constructing Tiger teams as a means of tearing into the massive workload that has resulted. Tiger teams being specialized cross-functional teams brought together specifically to solve or investigate one particular problem or critical issue. Between technology issues, which may prove to be intransigent, travel restrictions and shipping delays involved in replacing these systems, Keller predicts that agencies are months away from being able to address Log4J, despite the fact that, you know, the CISA said, no Christmas for you until we got this fixed, where you're not going to go home, you're just going to stay here. Well, everybody left. And so it's going to still be a few months before things calm down. An example of a specific and unfortunately typical Log4J-based vulnerability has been found in a popular open-source, Java-based, of course, database engine library. That Maven Java repository, which Google had plumbed and we talked about before, indicates that this popular, it's called the H2 database engine, is being used by 6,807 individual, what they describe as artifacts, meaning, you know, up tree dependencies. Or dependents, rather. We've talked about the tree of dependencies that one gets when libraries are built from libraries, which are built from libraries, and so on. In this case, this HS database appears somewhere underneath those 6,807 different high-level Java things. And since this is an embedded database engine, you know, where you typically don't even see it, right? It's just like your thing like has a database that comes from somewhere. Well, this is where it comes from, but you never really see the H2 embed. So it might not even be clear to those using it that accessible Log4J vulnerabilities are buried underneath there. This particular issue being tracked is CVE-2021-42392 and has been described as, quote, the first critical issue published since Log4Shell on a component other than Log4J that exploits the same root cause of the Log4Shell vulnerability, namely that JNDI remote class loading. Shachar Minash, the senior director of JFrog Security Research, said, quote, similar to the log4shell vulnerability uncovered in early December, attacker-controlled URLs that propagate into JNDI lookups can allow unauthenticated remote code execution, giving attackers sole control over the operation of another person or organization's systems. So basically, that's, you know, what we know of as the log4j problem in a nutshell. He added that, quote, the H2 database is used by many third-party frameworks, including Spring Boot, Play Framework, and JHipster. While this vulnerability is not as widespread as log4shell, it can still have a dramatic impact on developers and production systems if not addressed. So, yeah, 6,807 of them. The flaw affects H2 database versions 1.1.100, so that sounds like almost at the start, to up through 2.0.204, and it's been addressed in .206, which was first made available last Wednesday, January 5th. And I should note that the JFrog folks, who I was unaware had their eye on this, we'd run across them a couple times before relative to Java stuff. They've got a terrific page of log4j and log4shell resources, including a remediation cookbook, free scanning tools to see if you've got the problem, and what they call a survival guide. I have a link to their page in the show notes, but you can just put JFrog, J-F-R-O-G, into any search engine and click, after you go to their page, click the banner link that they've got at the top of the homepage, and that'll take you to their very comprehensive log4j, log4shell resources. Yeah, it's right there at the top, Leo. Is it that little black bar? Yeah, there it is. Yep, and there you are at the resource page. So definitely a useful resource for any of our listeners or their friends who are part of that month-long remediation battle for getting this thing under control. Okay, now, this sort of surprised me. A week ago, on the 4th of January, while we were doing this podcast, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission posted a blog warning, essentially warning companies to remediate the log4j security vulnerability. The blog's title, the FTC's own blog title, is FTC Warns Companies to Remediate log4j Security Vulnerability. And in its posting, it directly threatens companies with legal action, likening it to the Equifax negligence. So here's what the FTC posted. They said, log4j is a ubiquitous piece of software used to record activities in a wide range of systems found in consumer-facing products and services. You know, thus the, you know, FTC's charter. They said, recently, a serious vulnerability in the popular Java logging package, log4j, and then they cite the CVE 44228, was disclosed, posing a severe risk to millions of consumer products, to enterprise software and web applications. This vulnerability is being widely exploited by a growing set of attackers. They said, when vulnerabilities are discovered and exploited, it risks a loss or breach of personal information, financial loss, and other irreversible harms. The duty to take reasonable steps to mitigate known software vulnerabilities implicates laws including, among others, the Federal Trade Commission Act and the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. It is crucial that companies and their vendors relying on log4j act now in order to reduce the likelihood of harm to consumers and to avoid FTC legal action. They said, according to the complaint in Equifax, a failure to patch a known vulnerability irreversibly exposed the personal information of 147 million consumers Equifax agreed to pay $700 million to settle actions by the Federal Trade Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and all 50 states. The FTC intends to use its full legal authority to pursue companies that fail to take reasonable steps to protect consumer data from exposure as a result of Log4j or similar known vulnerabilities in the future. So, yikes. That's a newly aggressive tone from the government side that sort of feels like it's getting a little tired of having companies say, well, it's not our fault. We, we had to go home for Christmas. You know, Christmas happens. The FTC added an interesting acknowledgement, perhaps in response to anyone wanting to hold the Log4j authors accountable, which you can imagine would be what some pencil neck C-suite guy would say, hey, it's not our fault. It's their software. So the FTC closed their blog posting by writing, quote, the Log4j vulnerability is part of a broader set of structural issues. It is one of thousands of unheralded but critically important open source services that are used across a near innumerable variety of internet companies. These projects are often created and maintained by volunteers who don't always have adequate resources and personnel for incident response and proactive maintenance, even as their projects are critical to the internet economy. I thought this was really interesting that this was in this otherwise very aggressive posting. They finished, this overall dynamic is something the FTC will consider as we work to address the root issues that endanger user security. In other words, it sounds like they're saying, look, we recognize that this is, a thankless job that volunteers are doing for the benefit of all. And yeah, they make mistakes, but we're not going to hold them responsible. We're going to, when vulnerabilities are disclosed and widely publicized and you're told that you can't go home for Christmas, if you do that anyway, and consumers are harmed, you're not going to be able to blame the author of the software. So, wow. In browser news, Chrome fixed 37 known problems last week. I'll note in passing that last Wednesday, Chrome received its first update of 2022, which moved Chrome to 97.0.4692.71. The update did not fix, refreshingly, any disclosed zero-day vulnerabilities. As far as we know, there weren't any, but it did address 37 security-related issues, one of which is rated critical in severity and could be exploited to pass arbitrary code and gain control over a victim system. So that baddie is another of the apparently ubiquitous use-after-free bugs, this one having resided in Chrome's storage component. If exploited, it could have had devastating effects ranging from corruption of valid data to the execution of malicious code on a compromised machine. So it's a good thing that Chrome auto-updates. Everybody's is fixed. I checked mine because my Chrome, as we know, is famously sluggish in updating itself. But I was happy to see that I was also at .71. So good. 24 out of the total of 37 flaws were reported to Google by external researchers, and they consider their Project Zero initiative to be external, I guess, to the Chromium project itself, because, of course, as we know, Project Zero looks at everything, does, and has helped lots of other non-Google, even Google competing projects. The other lucky 17 flaws were flagged as part of Google's own continuous internal security work. of the 24 externally reported bugs, 10 were rated high severity, 10 were given medium rating, and the rest were low. The Privacy First Brave browser. I thought it was interesting, following up on last week's discussion of DuckDuckGo's continuing dramatic exponential growth, I wanted to also note that the Brave browser's 2021 usage more than doubled from its previous year. Brave began 2021 with 24.1 million users, those monthly million users, and ended the year with 50.2 million for a 220% growth during 2021, up 2.2% or 2.2 times. And this growth is also exponential since Brave has been more than doubling their user base year after year now for the past 5 years. And for those who haven't been following the Brave alternative closely, it's also based upon the now quite common Chromium platform and thus offers nearly all the features available in the other Chromium browsers, including Chrome and Edge. But Brave separates itself from them by explicitly not tracking searches or sharing any personal or identifying data with third-party companies like Google or Microsoft. In addition to its monthly active users, which is what I just quoted, jumping from to above 50 million. Brave is also seeing 15.5 million active users daily. And its mobile browser has received more than 10 million downloads. So anyway, it's doing great. And I know, Leo, I've heard you talking about Brave. I don't know.
They were an advertiser for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing I don't like about Brave is there's this kind of a tenuous attachment to crypto, its own cryptocurrency. And I always worry about that these days. You know, you saw probably Norton 360 now installs a crypto miner. You have an option not to, I guess, but still it's weird. And then Avira, which they bought, which is a free antivirus that was very popular, also is now doing that. So I get nervous when people get in the crypto sphere. Like, I don't know. But I like Brave a lot. If you want to use the reason I'm less bullish on Brave is everybody now makes a Chromium variant. You know, besides Edge, DuckDuckGo's will be Chromium when they do their browser. That's going to be one of interest. I think Brave is great because it's very privacy forward. I mean, I like Brave. I still use Firefox. Weirdly enough,
I do too. It's where all my tabs are that I open when I'm pulling the show together.
Yeah,
WordPress, as I mentioned, had a, you know, we ought to take a break here. We're half an hour in and we're at about the right place in the show notes. And I have a big bunch at the end. So we'll sort of, you know, load up here in the beginning.
Let's load up with the commercial goodness of Barracuda, ladies and gentlemen, our fine sponsor for this segment. If you listen to this show, I don't have to tell you this statistic. Every 11 seconds, there is a new ransomware attack. I don't know if it's going up or down. I mean, we've started to make a little progress in arresting these people, but I don't think it's going away. And it does take such a toll on any organization that gets hit by it, especially if it's an infrastructure company like the Colonial Oil Pipeline. In fact, that's, I think, one of the reasons the U.S. government now classifies ransomware as terrorism. I mean, it can really devastate a country. According to Verizon's 2021 Data Breach Investigations Report, here's the answer to that question. Ransomware has more than doubled year over year. Okay. In its most, if you don't read this, by the way, you should, but Barracuda has a blog, the Threat Spotlight Research blog. It is fantastic. In their most recent, they identified and analyzed 121 incidents from August 2020 through July 2021, seeing a 64% increase in attacks year over year. I bet you the 2022 report, which of course will be in a few months, is going to show an even greater increase. Oil pipelines, universities, city governments, corporations, costing millions of dollars. Barracuda wants to put out the word,
You see it right here. Don't pay the ransom. Don't pay the ransom. That's easy to say. Once you get bit, you may be very well tempted. So the key is protect yourself and your company before a ransomware attack occurs. Part one, attacks start with an innocent-looking email trying to trick people into revealing critical information, usernames, passwords, maybe click on a link. Train your teams to recognize an attack, and you should be deploying anti-phishing technology. Step two, secure your web applications. Those are often a backdoor into your system. File sharing services, web forms, e-commerce sites often have weak points, maybe even exploits that hackers can find and take advantage of. Once they're in your applications, they go after your business data. Protect your applications so they can't get into your network. Step three, we say this over and over, back up your data. Today's backup solutions make it simple and fast to protect archives and backup or restore an entire server or just an individual file. There's lots of benefits. Honestly, I think as much data loss occurs from human error as from ransomware, you will want to be able to recover that data and not pay the ransom. Don't pay the ransom. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now before they strike. Help is out there. Go to barracuda.com/security now for more. And, of course, they make some great stuff that will help you too. Barracuda.com/security now. Build your ransomware protection plan now with help from Barracuda. Okay, Steve, back to you.
So, as I was saying of WordPress, excuse me. Since so much of the web is actually just styled WordPress PHP, I thought it was worth noting that the WordPress core code itself has just received an update that might be important. Well, is, depending upon your configuration. As we all know, by far, WordPress's biggest security headaches arise because WordPress is, by design, a user-extensible platform. And those who are extending it don't necessarily need to be highly skilled in PHP coding or security before offering well-intentioned, though horribly insecure, add-ons, many of which go on to become highly popular before someone who is highly skilled in PHP and security finally gets around to taking a look at what everyone is using and then immediately sounds the alarm. Consequently, this podcast is routinely passing along the news that this or that highly used WordPress add-on needs to be updated with the result of professional oversight, which it finally received. But not today. Today, WordPress itself is in need of some tender loving care. Yesterday's just released version 5.8.3 is not ultra critical, but it's probably worth getting around to for anyone who's not using WordPress's automatic updating mechanisms, which for the couple years that I was using WordPress, I certainly had turned on, being a believer in the need for that. and it saved me a couple times. The update to this 5.8.3 eliminates four vulnerabilities, three rated as highly important. There's CVE 2022-21661, which is a high-severity SQL injection via WP query. It's exploitable via plugins and themes that use WP query. It can and should be applied to versions all the way back to 3.7.37. So that problem's been around for quite a while. We've got the CVE ending in 21662, also high severity, also with a CVSS of 8.0, so not to be taken lightly. That one's a cross-site scripting vulnerability, allowing authors, which is to say lower privilege users, to add a malicious backdoor. this is not good. Or take over a site by abusing post slugs. The fix also covers WordPress versions all the way back to 3.7.37. The next one is CVE 21664. That's the third high severity flaw. Although that CVSS is down to 7.4, still ought to get your attention. It's the second SQL injection, this time via WP Meta Query Core Class. And doesn't go back quite as far, so it was introduced in 4.1.34. And then lastly, the 21663 is a medium severity, down with a CVSS of 6.6, an object injection issue that can only be exploited if an attacker has compromised the admin account. So not bad, but you know, you get to fix that one when you're fixing all three high severity problems. So there have been no reports of any of these ever being seen exploited in the wild, but WordPress being PHP means that anyone who is inquisitive will be able to quickly determine what the flaws have long been, because you just do a diff on the pre-release PHP and the post-release PSP PHP, and you see what they changed. So, you know, they could be used in attacks by somebody so inclined. So again, while not super critical, definitely worth doing. And of course, CVSSs with an 8 should not be left in place if given a choice. Okay, Leo. What exactly is a Pluton?
We asked this on Wednesday on there Windows Weekly. Yes,
what the hell is that? There was some discussion. I had you guys, you know, running in the background while I was working on SpinRite. Pluton,
yeah,
is Microsoft's wonderfully named CPU integrated TPM technology. Now, the press is deeply confused, and you guys had every right to be confused about what exactly Pluton is, thanks to Microsoft's own original, horribly titled announcement of Pluton back on November 17th of 2020. The announcement's title was, "Meet the Microsoft Pluton Processor, the security chip designed for the future of Windows PCs." That's great. But only after making the significant correction that what Pluton is specifically not a security chip. It's got nothing to do with security chips.
Yeah, okay.
Now, and that's Pluton's entire point. Pluton, and yes, I do love saying the word, is Microsoft's silicon design for an on-chip, on-CPU integrated TPM equivalent technology. Microsoft designed the spec and the silicon and has arranged for Intel, AMD, and Qualcomm to integrate this core technology directly into their cores. So the problem with any external, physically separate, trusted platform module is specifically that it's external and physically separate. That means that its lines of communication between it and the system's processors is physically accessible on the motherboard's signal traces. Now, everyone has always known that, right? I mean, the problem is TPMs were never designed to protect against physical attacks. The idea was that a TPM would be a much better place to store encryption keys than either in firmware somewhere or on the disk, where they could be retrieved by malware. The TPM was designed as a secure enclave subprocessor where these secret keys could be used without them ever being disclosed. You'd give the TPM a hash of some blob that needed signing. And the TPM would use one of its internal private keys to encrypt the hash without ever exposing any of its keys to the outside world. But other applications for which the TPM was also used were less secure and securable. For example, when the TPM is used to hold BitLocker keys, the unlocked BitLocker key must eventually become external to the TPM in order for the system to use it to decrypt the drive while it's in use. Of course, Microsoft makes the Xbox, and they've been annoyed through the years by having their precious Xbox's security subverted over and over and over by hobbyist owner hackers who, Leo, had the audacity to think that they actually had the right to mess with the hardware that they purchased and owned. Imagine that. Can't have any of that. So, those days are numbered. Pluton moves the TPM on chip, and in doing so, it elevates the security provided by the TPM to also include total protection from physical attack. There will be nothing to attack. Basically, what this means is that our next generation processors from everybody, Intel, AMD, Qualcomm, they will just have that TPM stuff on chip, built in, not exposed. And so, for example, in the case of BitLocker, the BitLocker keys being used to decrypt the drive on the fly, they will never lose. They will never leave the silicon. They will never be exposed. So, you know, it definitely increases security. Unfortunately, it definitely decreases our ability to, you know, do things that we like to do with our Xboxes. So, anyway, that's Pluton. It is, you know, again, why Microsoft could announce it as a security chip when that's why they did it was so that it wouldn't be one is beyond me. But then, you know, Microsoft.
So it's what we thought, which is it's software.
No, it's not. It is silicon. It is firmware that they designed that they've convinced Intel, AMD, and Qualcomm to make some room for on their silicon dies moving forward. So it's a processor. It's a Microsoft designed security processor that instead of being external, thus exposed, is on the chip.
Okay.
And so you can't get to the communications between it and the other cores on the chip because, you know, they're all on the same chip. You know, you'd have to literally, you know, pop the lid and get really, you know, NSA-ish. But it's not something that Johnny can do, you know, in the garage in order to hack his Xbox any longer. Two quick notes. I am very much enjoying, I need to tell all of the Security Now listeners who recommended this, the first of Dennis Taylor's three Bobaverse novels. And I'm pretty certain that I'm going to enjoy the other two as well. It's a trilogy. And I'll probably be wishing for more. Now, I do need to provide a caveat. They're an entirely different style of writing than either Rick Brown or Peter Hamilton. Whereas both Rick and Peter are consummate and detailed world builders who spend a great deal of time carefully crafting their characters, you know, and then placing them into a fully articulated alternate reality, Dennis, by comparison, just gets right to it. You know, when you pick up a Peter F. Hamilton novel, you know, you have to be in the proper mood and in no hurry to reach the end because the end will not be in sight for quite some time, as you and I, Leo, have often commented. And similarly, each of Rick Brown's Frontiers Saga story arcs spans 15 moderate size, I guess what I would call chapter novels. So again, it's all about the journey with those guys, but Dennis Taylor's Bobaverse novels are fast and breezy. They're also a quick read. I just checked, and I was surprised to see that I was already 80% through the first one, and actually that's before I started waiting for Mac Break Weekly to end. Now I'm at 85%.
That's why we do long shows. There you go. We do it for you.
it feels like, you know, to me, like we just got started on this book and it's almost over. You know, on the other hand, Dennis wastes no time. You know, I love Peter F. Hamilton's work. It's definitely right up there among the best science fiction I've ever found. But Peter would still be talking about the shape of the rivets on the hull and how the microablation created by the thin gases of deep interstellar space while moving at near light speed would tend to give them more of an oval shape and flatten them over time.
Yeah. No, they don't. Okay. Bob doesn't care about that.
No. An interesting factoid, okay, but not crucial to the plot. So,
although you and I kind of like that stuff,
I do
love that. Yeah.
And I do. And in fact, I just told my nephew who is completely loving Rick Brown stuff. He's also in the middle of I'm blanking on the book, the one that we love, the Martian guy.
Oh, the new one, Project Hail Mary. Yes.
Project Hail Mary.
Yeah.
So I told him about the Bobaverse.
Yeah, but, Andy Weir also likes ablated spheroids and things like that.
Yes, exactly. So, but I also told Evan that it was going to be crucial for him to eventually moved to Hamilton. He's never read any Peter F. Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
He's definitely a sci-fi
Fallen
fan.
Dragon. So, we all agree. Start with Fallen Dragon. Yeah.
I said, start with Fallen Dragon and then Pandora's Star followed by Judas Unchained. And boy, do you have a no hurry. We're not in any hurry. But I don't know. If you're probably as visual as I am, Leo. I have those worlds in head now.
That's why I prefer books to TV and movie sci-fi, because you can imagine something so much richer than they could ever put on screen.
Well, and we've lamented the fact that there's just, I mean, except for The Expanse, which I'm waiting to get done so I can cruise through the final
You like to binge it. You don't want to watch it a week by week. You're a binger.
But we used to have, like, back in the day, Jean-Luc was flying around. Like, for, 7 years? Yeah. There's no good sci-fi now. No. I don't, you know. No.
Foundation was terrible. Invasion was terrible. Wheel of Time, which is fantasy, not sci-fi, is worse than terrible. I'm so frustrated. I think I'm going to stick with the books. In fact, honestly, I still haven't seen The Expanse, despite your and many other people are recommending it. But I think I'm going to do the James S.A. Corey novels.
I did first. Yes. Yeah. Mark Thompson turned me on to them. He told me that The Expanse was in production. I read the novels first. Yeah. It's always the case. Oh, my God. Especially the first episode or two of The Expanse. You're like, what the heck is going on?
It was Amy Webb on Sunday said, turn on the subtitles for sure. Because that spacer lingo, it's hard to follow.
Yeah. Yeah, the good news is I tried to get Lori into Firefly, and she looked at it and had the same sort of feeling like, it's what? Except that we're now watching, she never watched Castle, and I'm a Nathan Fillion fan.
I love him, too, and he's great.
I just think he is so good.
Yeah. And so Firefly, was never a book, right? That was just a TV show, then later movie.
Correct. And Fox canceled it. Like, it was
barely... They ruined it.
It didn't even reach adolescence, and they killed it in its crib.
But that's, to me, the exception, because I loved that show. That was a great show.
Well, and what's so fun is that she's now fallen in love with Nathan Fillion. So after we get through with Castle, that went for like 8 years, and it's just, it's good writing, then I'm going to be able, she will then be able to do Firefly and then, of course, Serenity, the movie that was made from it, because fans just demanded more.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think the movie Serenity was crowdfunded at first, and then they said, all right, we'll make it. All right.
I think it was, and now, although
raised money.
Might be confusing it with The Expanse, because remember the what was crowdfunded was flying an airplane around the Amazon headquarters in order for Bezos to finally say okay, fine,
we'll green light.
And he really liked the series too, so he decided to pick it up. And and I have to say the ones that Amazon did had a higher level of production.
Oh,
quality.
Okay. See, I haven't even gotten that far. I've only watched the first 5 or 6 episodes of the first season.
It really is good.
I'm going to do the books, and then I'll come back. Yeah.
For what it's worth, on the Babaverse trilogy, 88% of the reviewers on Amazon gave it 5 stars. The other 12% gave it 4. Nobody gave it fewer than 4. They're available through Kindle Unlimited. So if you're a reader and you're a Kindle Unlimited person, they won't cost you anything. And again, it's a different kind of style, but sometimes it's just fun to get on with it. I mean, I've noticed that television shows where a lot happens in an hour, you feel like you got something for your time instead of like stretching it out for no good reason.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, I am continuing to move forward nicely with Spinrite. As I have been, I'm focusing upon all of the outlier machines our various testers have managed to throw at it. And since I'm always working to find a generally applicable generic solution rather than doing any special casing. So far, I have no special casing code in Spinrite. It's getting generally more robust with each success because it'll be able to take things in stride that it's never seen before, which are also, weirdos. So,
cool.
Okay. On that note, let's take our last break, and then we're going to plow into URL parsing vulnerabilities.
Oh, wow. You're jam-packing this show full of goodness. Our show today, I love how he does it. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. We talk about VPNs all the time. I've talked about ExpressVPN, my personal choice for a VPN. Really important. I can't underscore this enough, that you pick the right VPN, because otherwise you're just passing along the security and privacy issues you have with your ISP or your coffee shop to the VPN provider. You got to trust them. That's why I recommend and use ExpressVPN. So we talk about security. We talk about privacy. But there's another reason a lot of you use ExpressVPN: Netflix, or, pick your streaming platform of choice. Eliminating geographic restrictions, for want of a better phrase. If you're a Netflix, and by the way, this is completely legal. Netflix, I even asked them. They said, well, of course, if you have a Netflix subscription in the U.S., you can watch content in other countries. We disrecommend it because most VPNs are too slow to get HD video. And that's what I love about ExpressVPN. It is not a free VPN. It is not a VPN based on advertising. They charge around $7 a month. But there's a good reason why you want that. They put that money back into the infrastructure. So you can watch HD video on ExpressVPN. In fact, it's so fast, you won't even know you're using a VPN. So you subscribe to Netflix in your country. And you maybe by now, you've watched everything on there. I know I have. And you're looking for more. Well, with ExpressVPN, you can choose. They have points of presence. They have servers in 90 different countries. You could choose any one of those countries. Normally, what happens with ExpressVPN, they've got these great apps, very simple. They're everywhere, iOS, Android, Mac, Windows, Linux. You could put them on your router. And normally, there's a big button. You press that, and it will pick the nearest server to you for the best speed. But you can override that. You could say, no, I want to be in England. And you will emerge in London onto the public internet, and then you'll be able to watch Netflix England. And because, again, they put money in the infrastructure, two benefits to that if you want to do geographic restrictions, eliminate them. Speed, of course, so you can watch HD video. The other thing is they're constantly refreshing their pool of IP addresses. There's a little cat and mouse game. Some providers say, oh, I see you're coming in on a VPN address. You can't use us. Well, a good VPN provider doesn't reuse the same address over and over again. ExpressVPN constantly rotating them. So it really works with many other streaming services, including BBC iPlayer, which is only available in the UK, Netflix in Japan, in England, all over the world. ExpressVPN, number one rated VPN by publishers like Business Insider. Of course, I've been telling you about it for years. ExpressVPN.com/security now. So be smart. Protect your data. Protect your privacy. Stop paying full price for streaming services while only getting access to a fraction of their content. And get the value of streaming services by using them all over the world. ExpressVPN.com/security now. Visit them right now. Get 3 extra months of service for free. Bringing the price down below $7 a month, which I think is exactly right. It's not too much, but it's also not too little. That's really important. ExpressVPN.com/security now. Get the best at the right price. ExpressVPN.com/security now. When you sign up for a year, you get 3 extra months, and that's a very nice discount. All right. I think it's time to talk about the subject of the day, URL parsing.
Indeed, and I just sent you a text with the link to the SodaStream refill adapter.
we were talking before the show about why never to buy SodaStream cartridges. They're overpriced. Steve has, of course, a Rube Goldberg invention for making it possible for a lot less.
$17 for the little brass gidget that allows you to refill your own SodaStream cartridges. So it's definitely a win. Okay. URL parsing vulnerabilities. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this week's topic centers around the work of 4 security researchers, 2 from SYNC, spelled, and I guess all the normal spellings are gone. So SYNC spells their name S-Y-N-K, and 2 from Clarity, spelled C-L-A-R-O-T-Y. Okay.
What the what?
I know. Okay. They're both in the Northeast U.S., as I mentioned. They decided to take a closer look at another set of wildly popular and widely used libraries. Naturally, I mean, URL parsing, come on, like everything needs to do that, which, as a consequence of that, would inherently have broad exposure to external attack. The title of this week's podcast, URL Parsing Vulnerabilities, discloses their wisely chosen, in retrospect, research target and suggests what they did indeed find. I have a link in the show notes to their 15-page PDF for anyone who wants to dig in deeper than I do, although we're going to be digging in plenty deep. What they said was, to like set the stage, the uniform resource locator, the URL, is integral to our lives online because we use it for surfing the web, accessing files, and joining video chats. If you click on a URL or type it into a browser, you're requesting a resource hosted somewhere online. As a result, some devices, such as our browsers, applications, and servers, must receive our URL, parse it into its uniform resource identifier, URI, components, for example, the host name, the path, and so forth, and fetch the requested resource. The syntax of URLs is complex, and although different libraries can parse them accurately, it is plausible for the same URL to be parsed differently by different libraries. The confusion in URL parsing can cause unexpected behavior in the software, like a web application, and could be exploited by threat actors to cause denial of service conditions, information leaks, or possibly conduct remote code execution attacks. In Team 82's joint research with SYNC, we examined, they wrote, 16 URL parsing libraries written in a variety of programming languages and noticed some inconsistencies, which is putting it mildly, as we'll see, they said, with how each chooses to parse a given URL into its basic components. We categorized the types of inconsistencies into 5 categories and searched for problematic code flows in web applications and open source libraries that exposed, indeed, a number of vulnerabilities. We learned that most of the 8 vulnerabilities we found, and by the way, they all have CVEs assigned. I mean, these are real problems, largely occurred for 2 reasons. First, multiple parsers in use. They said whether by design or an oversight, developers sometimes use more than one URL parsing library in projects. Because some libraries may parse the same URL differently, vulnerabilities can be introduced into code. The second, specification incompatibility. They said different parsing libraries are written according to different RFCs or URL specifications, which creates inconsistencies by design. This also leads to vulnerabilities because developers may not be familiar with the differences between URL specifications and their implications. For example, what should be checked or sanitized. I thought that the first case, the probably inadvertent use of different parsers, was really interesting, where developers might make the reasonable but ultimately incorrect assumption that different areas of their code would decompose input URLs the same way. And I invented a typical instance of how that could go wrong. It's not one that we'll be talking about in a second. But for example, imagine that upon decomposing a URL into its various pieces, those pieces were sized and storage was allocated to fit. But the code wasn't yet ready to fill those buffers. Then later, when the code was ready, the same URL was again parsed, with the URL's component data finally being copied into the previously allocated storage. The programmer could assume that since the same URL was being parsed both initially and later, the component pieces would naturally be the same size. But if different URL parser libraries were used, and they interpreted the URL's format in slightly different ways, the allocation might not fit its data, and a buffer overrun might occur. So, for example, their second issue, which they termed specification incompatibility, is a variation of a fundamental programming challenge that I've spoken of from time to time and also recently. My term for it is weak definitions. If a coder is not absolutely certain what something is, for example, a variable represented by a name, that coder, or God help us, some future other coder, might come along and use that variable differently because its purpose wasn't made absolutely clear and obvious by its name. You misname something, you're gonna come back later and forget that you, like, at while you were coding, you ended up, using it differently than you originally thought you were going to because of the name you gave it, which is no longer correct. So, and I find myself often going back and, like, fixing names of things when I go, ooh, right, that's not really what it's doing any longer. I better fix that now. So, and in fact, we have another example of the URL parsing duality dilemma right in our own backyard with Log4j. During our final podcast of 2021, we talked about how the Log4j trouble was that a URL of the form JNDI colon, and then using LDAP as the scheme, so LDAP colon slash slash, and then, for example, evilhost.com/A, was being parsed from within a log message. Log4j, upon seeing that URL, would dutifully run out onto the internet to fetch whatever from wherever. So, easy to solve this problem, right? Just create an access whitelist of allowable hosts for that JNDI URL lookup, and default the whitelist to only containing a single entry for localhost, which was probably the only valid source for JNDI material to come from anyway, right? Problem solved. Not long. And that was the first fix that was offered to this problem. Not after that first fix was added, a bypass was found, and it was even awarded a CVE number, 45046, which once again allowed remote JNDI lookup and allowed the vulnerability to be exploited in order to achieve remote code execution. So, how was the clean and simple valid host targets whitelist bypassed?
Yeah, how?
The new hack to bypass the whitelist used a URL of the following form, and this actually worked. It used LDAP:/127.0.0.1
localhost, yeah.
The localhost #
uh-oh.
Dot evilhost.com :1389/A. Believe it or not, tucked inside the log4j code are two different URL parsers. I kid you not. One parser is only used for validating the URL, whereas another is used for fetching it. In order to validate that the URL's host was allowed, Java's built-in URI class is used. The Java's built-in URI class parsed the URL, extracted the URL's host, 127.0.0.1, and checked if the host is inside the whitelisted set of allowed hosts. And indeed, if we parse the URL,
fine.
Yeah, no problem.
You take it from here.
Right. However, it was discovered that when the JNDI lookup process actually goes to fetch this URL, it does not fetch it from 127.0.0.1. Instead, it parses URLs differently. It makes a request to 127.0.0.1 .evilhost.com. In other words, the subdomain of evilhost.com. Again, 127.0.0.1 .evilhost.com, which is exactly what the bad guys figured out they could do. So, after being initially shut down by the update, which added the whitelist, because after all, we wouldn't want to simply remove some dangerous and completely unneeded functionality from Log4j, the bad guys simply tweaked their evilhost.com server to reply to subdomain queries, and they were back up and hacking. And as we know, that dangerous and completely unneeded functionality was finally disabled by default after, what, the fifth try at fixing the Log4j vulnerability. Okay, so what's relevant for us today is that this just actually happened in the very real world. That is, this Log4j thing, we just saw a URL parsing being done differently in two different places, actually causing a real-world problem. Okay, so what did this new team turn up when they really dug into this? They said, throughout our research, we examined 16 URL parsing libraries, including URL-lib, a Python library, URL-lib3, also Python, RFC-3986, which is the name of a Python a URL parsing library, HTTP-tools in Python, curl-lib in CURL, wget, the Chrome browser itself, URI, which is a .NET library, URL in caps, which is a Java library, URI, a Java library, parse_URL, which is a PHP library, lowercase URL, which is a Node.js library, URL-parse, also Node.js, net/URL, which is written in Go, URI lowercase in Ruby, and URI uppercase for Perl. So, yeah, as I said, URLs are everywhere, and there are 16 different parsing libraries. No two of them do the same thing, despite the fact that they're all trying to do the same thing. They said, we found five categories of inconsistencies: scheme confusion, slashes confusion, backslash confusion, which is different from slashes confusion, URL encoded data confusion, and scheme mix-up. They said, we were able to translate these inconsistencies into five classes of vulnerabilities: server-side request forgery, cross-site scripting, open redirect, filter bypass, and denial of service. In some cases, these vulnerabilities could be exploited further to achieve a greater impact, including remote code execution. And they finished, eventually, based on our research and the code patterns we searched, we discovered 8 vulnerabilities in existing web applications and third-party libraries written in different languages used by many popular web applications. Okay, all 8 of those have been assigned, as I said, CVEs, because, as we'll see, they're really not good. After digging through all of those libraries and the applications that use them, they found, as I mentioned earlier, 5 different situations where most, as they put it, of the URL parsers behave unexpectedly. And that's the scheme confusion, slash confusion, backslash confusion, URL encoded data confusion, and scheme mix-up. When we're not sure what we want or where we're going, it's often difficult to create a specification for that mission, which is fuzzy, beforehand. And probably nowhere has this proven to be more true than for the exacting definition of the format of the URL. The trail of obsoleted and abandoned URL RFCs, you know, the formal specifications of things, speaks volumes. The original URL RFC was 1738, and it was updated by 1806, 2368, 2396, 3986, 6196, 6270, and 8089. And along the way, it was obsoleted by 4248 and 4266. Then you have the RFC for the more generic URI. It also updates the original 1738, obsoletes 2732, 2396, and 1808, and is then itself updated by 6874, 7320, and 8820. So imagine being a coder who's trying to decide how to handle every possible curve that somebody might either accidentally or maliciously toss down the throat of your URL interpreter. And as if that all weren't enough, there's also the what WG, which is WHATWG, and their TWUS, which is TWUS. What WG, that is WHATWG, is the Web Hypertext Application Technology Working Group, what WG, a community founded by well-meaning individuals, I'm sure, from leading and technology companies who have tried to create an updated, true-to-form URL specification and URL parsing primitive. Because, you know, the final RFC, we don't know. This resulted in the TWUS, the what WG URL specification, TWUS, while it's not very different from the most up-to-date URL RFC, which we left off at 3986, minor differences do exist. For example, while the RFC differentiates between backslashes and forward slashes, where forward slashes are treated as a delimiter inside a path component, and backslashes are a character with no reserved purpose, what WG's specification states that backslashes should be converted to slashes and then be treated the same as. What WG's rationale is that this is what most popular web browsers do. Browsers, it turns out, treat forward and backslashes identically, and we'll see later that they do this on purpose. So what WG feels that what they regard as their so-called living URL standard should correspond with common practice rather than being some stodgy old numbered document that, you know, isn't what people are doing anyway. But this living URL standard broke compatibility with some existing standards, as we know, and with the contemporary URL parsing libraries that followed. It turns out these interoperability issues remain one of the primary reasons why many maintainers of some parsing libraries have just said, okay, wait, we're sticking with the RFC, that being 3986, even though they don't do that correctly either. At least their intention was in the right place. So this brings us to scheme confusion, a confusion involving URLs with missing or malformed schemes. Of this, the team wrote, "We noticed how almost any URL parser is confused when the scheme component is omitted. That's because RFC 3986 clearly determines that the only mandatory part of the URL is the scheme. That you have to have that. Whereas previous RFC releases, that is to say RFC 2396 and earlier, don't specify it. Therefore, when it's not present, most parsers get confused. And the real-world behavior they show," this is me talking, "is unsurprising and worrisome." They ask, these guys, the researchers, asked 5 different popular Python libraries to parse the schemeless input, just google.com/ABC. Most of the parsers, when given the input google.com/ABC, state that the host is empty. The host being google.com. Most of the parsers say, you've got no host. While the path they have as google.com/ABC, which is wrong, obviously. However, URL lib 3 correctly states that the host is Google and the path is /ABC, while HTTP tools complains that the supplied URL is invalid. Okay, because it's really adhering to the spec, right? And if you don't have a scheme, RFC 3986 says you're not going anywhere. When supplied with a schemeless URL, almost no URL parses the URL correctly because the URL does not follow the RFC specs. But most don't complain. They just guess. And most of them guess differently. CURL's parser dealt with a missing scheme by providing its own, guessing at what was not provided. It got the right result, but should it have guessed? Could there be, you know, an abusable downside to such guessing, one might ask. In their report, they then provide a sample bit of Python code to show a real-world example of how a security bypass might occur as a direct result of these parsing differences. And when I first encountered that, I thought, okay, they've constructed an example synthetic of like how this would happen. They use URL split, which is a function imported from the URL lib.parse library in order to do the splitting. And then later they use, netloc, in the parsed URL library, in order to perform the fetch. And exactly the problem that we were talking about occurs, because in this block of code, two different URL parsers are being used. I learned later that this is actual Python code in a highly used library, which is handling these malformed URLs exactly in this wrong way. And it is used everywhere. That's unbelievable. Pool manager is the function in URL lib 3, which is invoked. And that's like what everybody uses to pull queries across the web. Okay, so there's that. Another oddity they found was in the handling of irregular number of slashes. Oh, you're going to love this one, Leo. They called it slash confusion. Now, this is different than which way the slash is leaning.
Oh, okay.
But we get to that next. That's the backslash confusion. Slash confusion. I know, it's unbelievable. How does any of this actually work? The controlling RFC 3986 states that a URL authority. Okay, now the authority is the technical term for the domain or the host, what we all call the domain name or the host in the URL. The actual RFC calls it the authority. It states that the authority should start after the scheme, separated by a colon and two forward slashes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
HTTP://
Yeah.
How many times have I said that on the podcast?
Yeah.
It should persist. That is, the parsing of the authority should persist until either the parser reaches the end of a line or a delimiter is read, these delimiters being either a slash signaling the start of a path component, a question mark signaling the start of a query, or a hashtag signaling the start of a fragment. So they played around with URLs beginning with a scheme, a colon, and three or more slashes, followed by a domain name and path. Apparently, the pattern matching that were being used found the colon slash slash and thought, aha, here comes the domain name. And when they immediately hit the third slash, they thought, ah, and there's the end of the domain name.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yeah. So
is it always, are they using regular expressions to do this?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, if you scroll down in the show notes at the top of page 13, you'll see the regex, which is that doing this.
Because regex is notoriously,
I know,
difficult, you have to, I mean, and easy to screw up. And this is.
Yes, it is super powerful,
yeah,
and so easy to have side effects that you don't anticipate.
Because the advent of code uses regex a lot. I've been writing a lot of regex lately. I love regex, and there's Jeffrey Friedel's book on mastering regular expressions is one of my favorite coding books of all time.
And boy, Leo, can you get yourself It like Forth is a write only language.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, they call it the problem with the toothpicks it gets crazy with all the escaping in the back, because that's part of the problem is backslash is often used to escape, and so sometimes you'll have backslash to escape a backslash. It gets kind of nutty.
Yeah, in fact, you will see in
more
red,
modern parsing libraries than regex.
Oh, Leo, nobody should be using it. You ought to use a careful algorithmic parser in order to take, because, I mean, it is a...
Like parsec or something, yeah.
It is a forward-moving flow with a, you know, a well-defined structure.
Yeah.
You know, follow the proper RFC.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly, and treat it that way.
Yeah.
You know, nobody does. And I'm 16 URL parsers. Let's write another one.
It's the age
of
the code, too. I mean, oh, God. And it's also,
yeah, I know.
I think this is in some ways an open source problem because.
Yeah, because you don't have to be an expert in order to throw out another URL parser and say, here, Jimmy's URL parser.
Yeah. And people, this is also a big problem, is people just use libraries and assume they're correct. You should definitely not mix libraries. That's really funny. That's really strange. Oh,
okay, so we have the problem that three slashes in a row causes a null host and the authority then to be moved to the beginning of the path that actually happens. Then we have the backslash confusion, a confusion involving URLs containing a backslash. RFC 3986, the controlling document, clearly specifies that a backslash is an entirely different character from a forward slash and should not be interpreted as one.
No.
This means the URL https://forward/google.com and https://google.com are different.
Yes.
And should be parsed differently.
Yes.
And being true to the RFC, most URL parsers do not treat a slash and a backslash interchangeably.
Well, that's a relief.
But our web browsers do.
Oh, no.
Yes, every web browser. When a URL having backslashes or even a mixture of backward and forward slashes is used in a URL, Chrome and its brethren are completely happy treating either as forward slashes.
So now, they're assuming maybe that users don't know the difference?
I think that's it. We might think that this wacky behavior occurs because most browsers follow that what WGURL specification, which states that backslashes should be treated the same as forward slashes, but it may be more accurate to say that the TWS spec follows the browsers rather than the other way around.
Yeah, because people, that for years, in fact, I just saw that TV ad the other day where they said instead of slash, they said backslash. And just and nobody caught it. They just read it that way. Nope. And I think it's because, well, backslashing was created by, people got used to it because of Windows' horrific use of it.
Oh, my God. And hasn't
DOS,
that been a sin?
Yeah.
Isn't that a sin that has hurt us?
I
whenever I'm like spending a lot of time in Unix and then I come back to Windows, I'm like, okay, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's like, which one do I use?
Oh, God.
Anyway, this code at the top of page 13 shows what the guy did on the second line where he's parsing. He's using a regex to parse out the authority. He's matching on the after finding the colon forward slash, he then sets up a group in order to grab the authority. And he's pulling together, and you can see it in marked in red at the top of page 13. I think it's a little
past
lower
that.
Than where you are.
Okay.
Or maybe it's above where you are.
It's above, yeah.
Yeah.
All this backslashing is making me nuts.
You can see top of page 13.
That's this.
Two. Really?
Oh, maybe.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. You're on their PDF. I'm on my show notes.
Oh, that's why. There you go.
sorry.
Okay, I'll find it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, they marked them in red, two backslashes in a row, which of course is an escape for a backslash, meaning I actually mean one backslash, but it's grouped in there along with a forward slash as being a valid terminator for the authority, that is for the domain name.
Here we go.
Okay. So this means that if an authority contains a backslash, URL lib 3 would split it out at that point and use only what appears before the backslash as the authority, then concatenating what follows the backslash to the front of the URL's path. Anyway, the bottom line is it's exactly what we were talking about, this problem that occurred in log4j. So for example, and here's where our listeners need to visualize. If you had http://evil.com/@google.com/, if the latest RFC is obeyed, as most parsers do, which specifies that backslash has no special meaning inside a URL authority, the malformed evil.com URL would be parsed as evil.com/@. Now, remember the old and now deprecated URL embedded username and password syntax. Remember, you used to actually be able to put a username and password in the URL?
Another bad idea.
Oh, my God. Really bad idea.
Oh, my God.
Oh, what were they thinking? Anyway, they first, you know, started saying we really don't think that's a good idea. Then they have formally now said no, that's no longer going to be considered legal. It should never be done. But it's still tolerated because of old URLs
right.
out there.
Right.
But so that means that everything in front of the at sign is considered user info, as it's termed. So that means that something that doesn't treat backslash especially inside the authority, as the RFC says you shouldn't, will end up parsing that with evil.com/@ as user info. And so the actual domain will start and be seen as google.com. Okay. The researchers tested this and found that, yes, indeed, this is what most of the RFC compliant parsers do.
This is harmless because it's ignoring evil.com.
Correct. They do not treat the aberrant backslash as the end of the authority. Since it precedes the at sign, they treat it as part of the user info, but not URL lib3, which is heavily used. URL lib3, as we saw in that regular expression, it's right above. It's at the top of that page 13. Yeah, if you scroll up, you'll see it. The second line in that chart, there are two red backslashes. There, that's in there as the terminator for the authority. That is that it and a forward slash, either of those. So they did it on purpose.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
You could see how easy this would be, though, if you look at this regular expression. To make a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so, okay, it's in there. Its result will not be the same. And here it is, Leo. Since the requests Python module, that's where that earlier snippet of code came from, uh-huh. A heavily used Python module, requests, uses URL lib3 as its primary parser while still using URL libs,
don't
URL
mix them.
Parse, and URL split for other purposes, yes, it mixes them. So we can easily run afoul of the differential parsing scenario we described earlier. And as I said, I thought when I first saw it, it was a synthetic example. No, it's right out of the Python code where it comes up with different answers. Okay, so we've established that a collection of five, what we might call exploitation primitives, exists. It should be clear that when parsing the same data, all URL parsers should be deterministic and should return identical results. When that is not done, the parsers introduce a dangerous uncertainty into the process to create a wide range of potentially exploitable vulnerabilities. They gave us a bunch. I'll just describe one. It's a very popular product called Clearance for Ruby. As a direct consequence of these parsing mistakes, the researchers discovered a dangerous and exploitable open redirect vulnerability in the Ruby gem package known as Clearance. And it was assigned to CVE 23435. Actually, 2021, 23435. Open redirect vulnerabilities enable powerful phishing and man-in-the-middle attacks by secretly redirecting a user's browser to fraudulent sites. The vulnerabilities occur when a web application accepts a user-controlled input that specifies a URL that the user will be redirected to after a certain action, such as a successful login or logout, occurs. In order to protect users from an open redirect attack, web servers carefully validate the given URL and allow only URLs that belong to the same site or to a list of trusted redirection targets to be used. So you can probably see where this is going, right? If you can't trust the thing that's parsing your verification, we just saw where a whitelist could be broken, then you're in trouble. And to make a long story short, what this thing allows is a bad guy to use these parsing vulnerabilities that are present in the clearance Ruby Gem package to perform successful man in the middle attacks to hijack people's sessions and bring them back after logging in to the bad site, even though that the victim site where the user logged in has explicit code to prevent that from happening because the danger is well understood. So this just ends up being a huge problem. In the case of this clearance package, as I said, it will redirect the user to a logged on page. In the show notes at the top of page 16, I show their example, which is brokensite.com/evil.com. When that ends up getting parsed by the broken parser, which the clearance package is using, it ends up giving the browser /evil.com. So what's a bit surprising is that if the user were using Chrome, Chrome would receive the URL /evil.com, which hardly seems valid and which we might expect Chrome to balk at. But web browsers, as we were talking about, have evolved to be hyper-lenient with what they will accept. After all, users are entering cryptic-looking URLs and aren't perfect. So Chrome's lenient behavior is, they consider it, a feature, not a bug. Mm. And in fact, in the Chromium source, in a big comment block, it says, "The syntax rules of the two slashes that precede the host in a URL are surprisingly complex. They are not required. Even if a scheme is included," and then they say http://example.com, no slashes, "is treated as valid," which I never knew. I'm not going to bother putting slashes anymore. They're just, you know, Chrome ignores them. And it says, "and are valid even if a scheme is not included." Then they say /example.com is treated as a file, as file:// example.com. He says, "they can even be backslashes." What? Yes, http://example.com and http, okay, no colon, http://example.com. This is Chrome's own notes. This is in a comment block. "Are both valid, and there can be any number of them." It actually says that. http://example.com and http://example.com are all valid.
And this is because users are going to type that. And so we just want to...
Yes, yeah.
And you can't really blame them for the log4j problem.
No.
That's log4j's problem in parsing its input.
Correct. Correct.
Because Chrome's a browser and it's just trying to do what it thinks you want.
Yes, exactly. It's going to try to make sense of what gibberish you've just typed into the URL and go, okay, let's guess here where they want to go.
Yeah.
So suffice to say that with all this, we have another example of longstanding, deeply embedded, critically broken code, which, despite now being identified, will remain in use until all references to it are eventually, if ever, weeded out. We also have another example, which I did appreciate, the fact that the researchers were able to see what was going on, of the power of open source software. The researchers were able to peer into the code to see and understand how it operated and what it does. The fact they didn't like what they found, well, they can fix it or find the guy who can fix it. The flip side, of course, is that malicious actors who have access also. But Overall, open seems clearly better, since when well-meaning researchers are able to offer feedback to make bad code better, that happens. Whereas bad guys need to operate with whatever they can find, unless they worm their way into being trusted on a project. That's the one case. Otherwise, they don't have the ability to make good code bad in the same way that researchers can help to make bad code good. So, thus the argument for letting lots of people look at it, and it's just going to kind of float to the surface and be good all on its own. But anyway, URL parsing vulnerabilities exist, and they're all around.
It's amazing. Just amazing. Yeah. Wow. And is this the root cause of the Log4j problem? Is just this inability to recognize malformed URLs?
No, actually, this intersected log. The root cause of Log4j is that you insanely processed a URL in a log output.
Right.
It's like, what?
That, you're right. That's a mistake by itself.
And so what happened was the first fix was to do a whitelist on the
and
the
that
domain.
That didn't work. Yeah.
And that because didn't work because of the parsing, the URL parsing vulnerability.
Wow. I bet it's turtles all the way down. I mean, honestly, you solve that and then you can find another one.
Yep. As we've said, security is porous. The harder you look, the more you find.
Yeah, that's amazing. What an interesting topic. I hope everybody subscribes to this show so they can hear this. Obviously, you're listening. Thank you. GRC.com is the place to go for Steve's website. That's where SpinRite, the world's best mass storage recovery and maintenance utility, lives. 6.0 is the current version. 6.1 is imminent. If you buy 6.0 now, you'll get 6.1 for free. You can also participate in the development of 6.1. Steve also has the show there, the 16 kilobit audio versions, as well as the 64 kilobit audio. He's got the show notes, as we mentioned. He also has transcripts a couple of days after the show. We'll have transcripts so you can, written by an actual human, so you can actually follow along or search for the topic you're interested in, et cetera, et cetera. This is a show I think people will share with one another just because that last part alone is really, really interesting. We have 64 kilobit audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN. You can always download any show there. There are 853 to choose from. This is the 853rd. There's a YouTube channel with all the shows dedicated to security now. And, of course, subscribing is probably the best thing to do. Get it automatically the minute it's available. And if your podcast player supports reviews, please tell the world how great Security Now is. Leave us a 5-star review so everybody can discover this show because they don't want to miss this. This is good stuff, Steve. If you want to watch us do it live, it's a little tricky because MacBreak Weekly is an accordion and can expand or contract completely at random. But nominally, we do this show 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern of a Tuesday afternoon. That's 21:30 UTC. And the live streams, audio and video, are at live.twit.tv. My suggestion is just have it on all day Tuesday. Start in the morning at 9 a.m. with Pacific iOS Today, then MacBreak Weekly at 11, Security Now whenever we get around to it, and All About Android after this. So, it's a big day. Tuesday's our biggest day, I think. Lots of good content all day long. So just have Twit on live all the time. That's my advice to you. There's a way you can support us. Of course, we're ad supported and everything, all our podcasts are supported by ads and the IRC and so forth. But we have a paid tier as well. If you'd like to contribute, it really helps us a lot financially with the vicissitudes, the ups and downs of advertising. $7 a month. What do you get? Well, I think it's a fair price for ad-free versions of this show and all the other shows, including video or audio, your choice. You also get the great Discord channel, which is so much fun. Our server runs all the time, has all sorts of topics from coding to motorsports. And, of course, every show has its own channel in there. Again, and everybody in there is a Club Twit member. There's also the Twit Plus feed with shows that we don't put out as podcasts, stuff that comes before and after each show. But we also are doing more and more special shows. For instance, Stacey Higginbotham's book club. She'll be doing Autonomous by Annalee Newitz. That's coming up. This week, Andy Iannocco is going to do an Ask Me Anything. Steve, I hope you will get a vitamin D thing out of you. You did the first Ask Me Anything some time ago. Yeah. There's the Untitled Linux show every Saturday. There's Giz Fizz before that. There's just lots of stuff. And we're looking at a new show that we're going to add. I think this is going to be our method for adding new shows in the future, is put them on Club Twit first, because no new show gets advertising. So if it's supported by Club Twit members, we can do that. So we'll put it on Club Twit first. And then if it builds an audience and we can sell advertising, then we'll put it on the main feed. And I think we've got a show coming pretty soon that's going to follow that model. So if you want to know more, twit.tv/clubtwit, twit.tv/clubtwit. There's individual memberships, corporate memberships too. A number of companies are doing that now for their employees. That's a nice benefit. Thank you. Appreciate your doing that. All right, Steve. I'm off to read The Expanse.
And to recharge your SodaStream.
Yeah. I got some questions about that. But we'll talk about that off the air. Thank you, Steve. Have a great week.
Okay, buddy. Ciao.
Android is constantly evolving, and if you're part of the Android faithful, then you'll be just as excited about it as I am. I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, along with my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, where every week we cover the news, we cover the hardware, and we cover the apps that are driving the Android ecosystem. Plus, we invite people who are writing about Android, talking about Android, and making Android onto the show. Every Tuesday at twit.tv, look for All About Android. Security now.